command of the Lord is clear.
It gives light to the eyes.
Good evening. I'm Mary Becker, and as chair of the Thomas Merton Center Foundation, I am so pleased to welcome all of you here this evening. It's a tradition of our foundation to mark and honor the passage of Thomas Merton from earthly life to eternal life, and we do that every year. And so tonight's program is a part of that tradition. It's also our tradition to always start with a prayer. And so I wish again to thank Brother Paul Quinnen and Father Jerry Eifler for putting together our lovely interfaith prayer service this evening. The title of our evening's presentation is The Almost Final Days of Thomas Merton, A Conversation with Harold Talbot. And I am so pleased to introduce to you our moderator and facilitator for this evening's presentation. She is Bonnie Thurston, who is the William F. Orr Professor of New Testament at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. Professor Thurston is also a founding member and longtime member of the board of the Society for Buddhist Christian Studies. She earned a BA in English from Bethany College and her MA and PhD degrees from the University of Virginia. She's done postdoctoral work in New Testament studies at Harvard, the Eberhard Karls University in Germany, and the Ecole Biblique in Jerusalem. Bonnie has written 9 books and published over 100 articles. And she's a founding member and past president of the International Thomas Merton Society. The subject of her dissertation was the later poetry of Thomas Merton. It was a study of how his changing theology was reflected in the stylistic features and subject matter of his poetry. Her basic conclusion was that Merton's increased knowledge of the Buddhist tradition was what led to changes in his Christian thinking. His study of Zen led, in her view, to extraordinary changes in his writing of poetry. She notes that if she were writing her dissertation today, she would also include the influence that Sufi Islamic mysticism exerted on his writing and thought, for that was considerable also. Among Professor Thurston's most recent books are To Everything a Season, The Spirituality of Time, which was published last year, and Fruit of the Spirit, Growth of the Heart, which was published this year. And I believe both of those books will be on sale at our reception afterwards. The format this evening is that Professor Thurston will introduce Harold Talbot, and the two of them will converse for 45 minutes or so, and then they will entertain questions from you. And you'll find in your program a small piece of paper that you can write questions on, and ushers will come toward the end of the conversation and pick them up and bring them up. And that part will last approximately 20 minutes. So please join me in welcoming Bonnie Thurston.
Thank you, Mary. What a lovely introduction. There is a large sign in front of me that says in capital letters, please don't lean on the podium. This morning it said, please don't pound on the podium, so things change. Those of us who are old enough to remember 1967-68 hardly remember it as an ironic time. In June of 1967, war broke out again in the Middle East. That same year, Martin Luther King Jr. called for civil disobedience, and Pope Paul VI called for a synod of bishops. 1968 saw the passage of a civil rights bill in March, followed by the assassination of Dr. King on April the 4th and Robert F. Kennedy on June the 5th. In the interim, we saw pictures of the student demonstrations at Columbia University, Merton's alma mater. And on November 5th, while Merton was in Dharamsala with His Holiness the Dalai Lama, the United States of America elected Richard Nixon president. These tumultuous events form the background of Merton's journey to Asia, a journey that was to preface his latest, last, and greatest journey. 1967-68 were clearly transition years for Merton as well as for the United States. He had moved into the hermitage at Gethsemane and settled into life there. If his journals are any indication, he seems to have recovered from his tempestuous experience with M. And in the fall and winter of 1967, Merton's journals reflect concern for the election of a new abbot at Gethsemane. Father Flavian Burns, you remember, was elected in early January of 68. The journals also reflect concern for the civil rights movement in America, the escalation of the war in Vietnam, and the American political scene. And we see in those journals of 67-68 Merton's continuing joy in the hermitage and his equally evident sense that he was too available and had too many visitors, although I must tell you I find a fair amount of pleasure in those too many visitors that he writes about. Father Flavian had an immediate effect on Merton as the abbot gave him permission to travel. From May the 6th to the 20th, 1968, Merton traveled to California and New Mexico, visiting other monastic establishments and looking for a place of greater solitude. But the big journey, which prefaced the final journey, began September the 11th, 1968. Something of Merton's mindset as he left on that journey is found in an excerpt from Robinson Jeffers' poem, The Torchbearer's Race, which he copied into his journal on September the 9th. We have climbed at length to a height, to an end, this end. Shall we go down again to Mother Asia? Some of us will go down. Some of us will abide, but we sought more than to return to a mother. This huge, inhuman, remote, unruled, this ocean will show us the inhuman road, the unruled attempt, the remote lodestar. From September 11th to October 14th, Merton traveled to New Mexico, Alaska, and back to California. And he left San Francisco on October the 15th, headed to the remote star, Mother Asia, to various Christian and Buddhist monastic establishments, and to attend a conference of Christian monastics in Bangkok in December. And we know it was his final earthly journey. In my view, the two most important parts of the Asian journey of Thomas Merton were his time in Dharamsala with the Tibetans and his visit to Palinurua. The Tibetan sojourn was arranged by Harold Talbot, who accompanied Merton for several weeks of travel and whom we are privileged to have with us this evening to tell us about that time. Talbot's acquaintance with Merton and the Trappists predated the Asian sojourn by a decade. In the late 1950s, Talbot was working on a newspaper in Memphis during his summer vacation from Harvard, and he read Merton's The Sign of Jonas. He traveled to Gethsemane to meet Merton, only to be turned away. But Harold is not easily turned away. He returned the following Thanksgiving, having been baptized in the Roman Catholic Church, to make his first communion at Gethsemane. Eventually, he went on to Asia as secretary to Dom Alred Graham of blessed memory. And one of the first things I am going to ask him is how the Merton connection came about. Today, Harold Talbot serves as president of the Buddhayana Foundation and works with the Marion Foundation in Marion, Massachusetts. He has collaborated with Tulku Thrandup Rinpoche, a Tibetan Lama, on several books, including The Healing Power of Mind, Enlightened Journey, Buddhist Practice as Daily Life, The the practice of Dzogchen, and most recently, boundless healing, meditation exercises to enlighten the mind and heal the body. Tonight, it's my great honor to introduce Harold Talbot to you and to share with you in the enlightenment that his presence and his words will bring us. You were studying in India in 68. Tell us about that, how you got there and what you were studying.
Well, I just want to preface it with a story that what you were saying made me remember that visit to Gethsemane. When I was allowed, finally, by Dom James Fox to come to Gethsemane and take First Communion, he allowed me to meet Merton. And Merton was the novice master, and he was very busy, and he arranged to just be walking through a corridor for a few moments on the way to his next engagement. And we met, and he took me into a little room. And he said, whenever I meet somebody who's just come into the church, I'm very happy because they're full of grace, and the grace overflows onto me. And 10 years later, Merton was staying with me in a bungalow in the Himalayas in Dharamsala, which had been provided me by the Dalai Lama. And I said to him, you know, I met you once before, and it was 10 years ago, and this is what you said to me. And he said, did I say that? That's pretty good. But what I was doing there was the fulfillment, for me, the way, in some ways, for Merton, it was the fulfillment of a great deal, to go and stay in Asia and meet, in this particular instance, Buddhist teachers. Meet in the flesh teachers of a esoteric tradition of spirituality, which had something to communicate to me at my level as a beginner and to him as a highly accomplished spiritual being. And all my life, I've been fascinated with Buddhism from childhood on, and especially because of having been shown photographs of Tibetans and Tibet by my mother, because she had a cousin named Major Brooke Dolan, who'd gone on an expedition to Tibet sent by the OSS with Colonel Ilya Tolstoy to try to open a land route of supplies for the Chinese, Chiang Kai-shek, in the war, because we could only fly the hump at that time. And the Tibetan government wished to remain neutral, and so they declined the request of the American government. But it did enable this cousin of my mother's to take a lot of wonderful photographs of Tibetans, including lamas and monks. And my twin brother and I, at the age of three, saw these photographs, and I flashed on them. And in my three-year-old mind, I said, these are the people I want to be with. So it didn't work out for a very long time, although I studied a bit of Sanskrit and Tibetan and was all set to go, but the circumstances just didn't present themselves. And then I had this huge opportunity because I had this friend, Mildred Graham, who was a Benedictine theologian and a very good Thomist from the 30s. And he was very, very interested in Buddhism, particularly Zen Buddhism, and he wrote a book called Zen Catholicism. And he got an advance from his publisher, and this enabled him to travel to Asia in 1967. And he'd been invited to be the peritus, or expert, on Buddhism at the Vatican Council, but he declined. And the way he phrased his declining of this invitation was to say that the encounter between Catholicism and Buddhism cannot take place at the level of the magisterium, the authoritative structure of doctrine of the church. It can only take place at the level of two contemplatives talking together in private. And so he finally had his opportunity to go, and Pope Paul VI heard that he was going and asked him to be his personal messenger to heads of non-Christian religions in Asia and the Middle East. And he accepted to do that. And so he hired me as his secretary to go on this journey and take recordings and notes of all of his conversations with these religious leaders. And when we got to India, we saw a lot of lamas, and we had an audience with the Dalai Lama. And the moment that I saw the Dalai Lama in this audience and heard him speaking to Father Elwood Graham, I had had my opportunity to see the Tibetans. And coming down the road in the jeep from that audience, a vow welled up in me. I vow to devote the rest of my life to the Dalai Lama and to the Tibetans.
It's a wonderful story. And here you are, fulfilling your vow with us. How wonderful.
In a rather piano way.
Well, now, this next question is from the Inquiring Minds Want to Know School of Questioning. And it is, since you traveled with Merton quite closely for several weeks, what sort of traveler was he? Is he the sort of person we'd want to be on a bus trip with?
Yes, very much so. I want to go back, if I may, to illustrate what kind of a guy he was. In one way, and hook Aylred back into the picture, because my friend Aylred Graham was a very different kettle of fish. She was a very brilliant intellectual and had a very systematic mind, whereas Thomas Merton, Tom, as he asked me to call him, was essentially a highly playful mind. One never knew what was coming next in terms of observation. He was totally on his own wavelength, and he had antennae all over the place and saw things. So if he let you in on what he'd seen in an encounter, it was almost as if he had eyes round the back of his head. He saw everything. And he was very, very funny. And he'd achieved a state in his personality where there wasn't the slightest malice, but there was an extraordinary amount of irony and good fun and fun poking at a great deal that was going on in the midst of the events and people that he encountered. I never, ever heard him speak ill of someone, except for anger, deep, deep anger about the circumstances of violence and injustice in the world. But he was very, very funny, and he had a certain kind of French malice. Oh, he was lots of fun to travel with. And the only problem was that you could tell, I mean, having only read a few of his books even, and knowing what kind of a person he was, a contemplative who'd been used to, you know, seeking as much solitude as he possibly could, carving it out, you knew that the thing that made him happiest was to be alone, either taking a walk, and he loved his camera, and he was a fantastic photographer, and the best way for him to go off and take photographs was to go on a walk by himself, you see. So you had to give him a lot of space, and that was a very great training, because one wanted to be with him.
Well, you're mentioning his books actually allows me to ask you another question, and this moves us to a little more substantive kind of discussion. Just before Merton died, really beginning 2 or 3 years before, he began not only to have read seriously in the Buddhist tradition, but to begin to publish particularly materials on Zen and the Birds of Appetite, which I take to be one of the seminal works in Buddhist-Christian dialogue, some essays in the collection Mystics and Zen Masters. My own knowledge here is limited, but it does strike me that the Zen tradition and the Tibetan tradition are quite different. And if I can make a coarse distinction, and you can correct me if it's too coarse a distinction, my sense is that the Zen tradition is quite ethereal, and the Tibetan tradition is a good deal earthier. Maybe you could correct my understanding about this. What I'm also interested in is why you think Merton took so quickly to the Tibetans, having come to Buddhism by another way.
Well, the last thing first. Tibetan Buddhism is a complete spectrum of all of the Buddhism that's developed throughout Buddhist history, starting with Theravada Buddhism, the early Buddhism of the Pali scriptures, and monastic ethics in which the aim is to avoid any opportunity to disturb the mind and cause emotional defilements and mental obscurations by avoiding through a monastic way of life. And that is the ground of all forms of Buddhism. And you know Satipatthana meditation, the counting the breaths and all of the kind of Shila, Samadhi, and Prajna, ethical discipline coming from the Vinaya, Samadhi, meditative states to arrive at of through calming the mind and then developing that calmed mind as an instrument to penetrate through to the real nature of things, beings, and phenomena. All of this comes from the original Theravada Buddhism. Then, around the first century of the Christian era, it branched out into Mahayana Buddhism. And this was partly because the emphasis in Buddhism had been so thoroughly monastic that there was a kind of welling up of the need for lay people to have access to the same form of spirituality. And so Mahayana Buddhism was a broadening out, characterized by, philosophically, the development of the doctrine of emptiness, which is the basis of Buddhist ontology, as you know, a rather forbidding word, especially to ourselves who have very positive expressions for absolute truth, such as God and the Spirit, etc. Emptiness does not sound like something you'd want to perceive or attain to necessarily, but really shunyata doesn't have that the actual Sanskrit word doesn't have that negative connotation. In fact, Buddhism exists to criticize two extreme views. One is eternalism, the notion that there is an eternal substratum of reality underlying the flux of phenomena. And the other is nihilism, the notion that there is no ontological basis for phenomena whatsoever. They just arise by chance, out of chaos, they have no meaning, they form and they dissolve, and that's it, and they don't have any philosophical connotation, or certainly no spiritual connotation. So the Lord Buddha criticized these two extreme standpoints, and emptiness is the state of understanding which is the middle way between eternalism and nihilism. And then the ethical and spiritual content of Mahayana Buddhism is compassion. Compassion for all sentient beings, the development of the bodhisattva ideal, and the aim to forget the self and to live entirely and exclusively for other beings. And that, of course, is the whole idea of tulku, or incarnation, incarnate lamas in Tibet, beings who have overcome their karma and therefore are able to choose to resist entering nirvana, the end of pain and suffering, and return to the focus of suffering to serve suffering beings. And so that's the Mahayana, and Tibetan Buddhism includes that as well as the early Theravada. And then it includes Vajrayana or Tantrayana Buddhism. And that's a fascinating and deep and, as you say, very, very earthy kind of spirituality, and it's directly addressing the nature of the mind. The emphasis is on inquiring into the mind's nature, and by all sorts of sadhana or methods of meditation and liberation to arrive at a recognition of the true nature of the mind. And that, I think, is why Merton found something highly valuable and very appealing to him in Tibetan Buddhism, whereas his studies had always been in Zen. I mean, he'd read books in English like The Life of Milarepa and been attracted to it. The other thing is, I think, the Tibetan nature itself. I mean, Merton was someone who loved to be in nature. He wanted to be a hermit. He was, in a way, a hermit. These are characteristics of a lot of Tibetan lamas.
What did they see in him, do you think? Oh, you've written that when Dom Alred met with them, it was a meeting of the minds. But when Merton met with them, it was heart meeting heart.
Mm. I don't think that Alred was exactly that interested in Tibetan Buddhism. He was tremendously interested in Zen. And he made his contribution to Buddhism, to the study of Buddhism on the part of Catholic thinkers in his time. But Merton said of Zen Catholicism, it's fine as far as it goes, but we've got to go a lot farther. And Merton was ready to plunge right in. And what I think that the Tibetans saw in Merton, the lamas that I had the good fortune to accompany him to see together, I think what they saw in him was someone who had done his homework already. It was not like the kind of person like myself who is going there to start training in the meditative life and has no antecedent basis in training. They saw Merton as a sort of fulfilled spiritual person and someone who could talk their language, however different the mode might be.
You've written a good deal about the great perfection as a way, or Dzogchen as a way in Buddhism. Could you tell us a little more about that? Mm. Especially since I think we are less familiar with that than we might be with other practices or other ways in the Buddhist tradition. I mean, you've just given us an immensely wonderful and compressed history of the whole Buddhist tradition in about 4 minutes, the best I've ever heard, so certainly you can do this bit now.
No, but you see, there's a problem. You're not supposed to. So
butter
there's
wouldn't
a
melt in her mouth.
But the thing is that there's a great urge to blurt on the part of Western students, you know. Tibetans and Tibetan lamas and spiritual teachers can't believe it that Americans can't keep a secret. The entire spiritual life in Tibet is based on secrecy. And the tantras are secret texts. When Merton went to see the abbot of Namgyal Tratsang, the chapter of monks that functioned in the Potala, the abbot said to him, Merton asked him about the mandala, because he wanted to see whether there was going to be any use for this design, this visual, symbolic method of meditative concentration for Western spiritual practice. And so he said, tell me about the mandala. And the abbot said, in Tibet, we would not say the word mandala to anybody except somebody who was a student of Tantra, and in his case, probably one of his monk students of Tantra. But since you've come from such a long distance, and I think also probably parenthetically not said, and since you obviously are such a highly attained person, I will tell you about the mandala. And he proceeded to explain elements of how this sacred diagram is used in Tibetan meditation for tantric training, to transform oneself into the deity whom one is, to whom one has devotion, and then Instead of ordinary devotion to a divine form, to experience oneself as the divine form, which is part of the higher tantras, and mandalas lead to that. So similarly, until a few years ago, the word Dzogchen was not spoken. And I had the great benefit of studying with Dujom Rinpoche, who was the head of the Nyingma school, the old school of Tibetan Buddhism, which has as its tantric training Dzogchen, and my own particular teacher, who sent me to Dujom Rinpoche to study, was very devoted to him, and I went to see Dujom Rinpoche to get Dzogchen teachings one day, and there was someone else in the room, and he didn't give me those teachings. So I went back to my teacher and said, unfortunately, I was unable to get the teachings that you sent me to get because there was someone in the room. And he said, Akaka, alas, alas, Dzogchen teachings are never given except in secret to a single person and usually whispered in the ear. So I'm a believer. And there are such beings as Dharmapalas, guardians of the Buddha's teachings, the Dharma, and they're protectors of particular tantric lineages and particular kinds of esoteric, spiritual, and meditative trainings. And if you were to go against the requirements of secrecy, you would cause anger on their part, and you would, reap the consequent karma. So what I can say is this, take it or leave it, there is, in the case of certain spiritual masters, certain lamas, a power to communicate from their mind to the mind of a student a vision, a way of viewing called Rigpa, intrinsic awareness. And this is done either in a liturgical setting by a method of abruptly awakening the mind when the Lama sees that the mind of the student is ready. Or else it can be done in a very, very informal context. It can be done harshly, and it can also be done in a mysterious way, such as tapping a glass or something like that. It's the power that a particular lama has in the case of a student who has true devotion to that lama, and there is such a thing as guru yoga, the yoga of veneration of the guru, in which you identify your own mind with the mind of the guru. And that kind of devotion is requisite for the lama, no matter how powerful he is, to be able to communicate, to do a mind-to-mind transmission, and to instill the capacity to practice intrinsic awareness, rigpa. And once that has been communicated, it probably is in a very fledgling form, very, very short span of time. The aim then in practice is to expand the span of dwelling in this intrinsic awareness. And within this intrinsic awareness, there are two aspects. One is emptiness, and the other is perception of phenomena. And they are all included in intrinsic awareness. So in my view, the thing that, well, not in my view, in my degree of being able to understand the Dzogchen view, what makes it special is this emphasis on intrinsic awareness. And other forms of Buddhist meditation emphasize emptiness, whereas Dzogchen emphasizes Rigpa, or intrinsic awareness.
That actually leads me to another question, and it has to do with Merton's visual orientation. You mentioned his taking pictures, and I like the image of eyes all the way around the head. It's a nice image. But in a book called The Hidden Wholeness, The Visual World of Thomas Merton, John Howard Griffin wrote, "This concept of going out to the thing and giving oneself to it, allowing it to communicate its essence, allowing it to say what it will, to reveal what it will, rather than trying to bring it into the confines of the self, altering it and changing it by possession of it, was one of Merton's profoundest orientations." It's very interesting. It struck me immediately that that kind of non-grasping attitude, that kind of open awareness, is a very Buddhist awareness for a Christian monk to have had.
I really think so. And that's the reason, I mean, of among many others, that I have such respect for Merton, that he could actually articulate such a thing. You couldn't do too much better about the close to the heart of Buddhism because of that non-attachment and non-modification of the object.
And that may have been one of then the really profound points of contact with the Tibetan tradition
as well. I do think so.
They shared that awareness with one another.
I think so. Yes. Yeah. Oh, you know, speaking of Dzogchen, though, I wanted to go back to something that was read at the beginning from the Asian Journal. And also an extremely striking passage of Merton's that I don't think you could do too much better, reflecting spirituality in general, but including Buddhist spirituality, about arriving at a state of mind in which the mind is free from fear, for example, and revulsion against, however he put it, against unwanted things, etc. And he said, "I don't know, I haven't tested to see whether this would work to the degree of being in a concentration camp. But I have a feeling," he was saying, "I think, that this is something that would work in extremis." Well, there are many, many people who have been Dzogchen practitioners, who have been in prison camps. One of them I can think of, Yangtang Tulku Rinpoche, for 23 years. And when he got out, he was celebrated for having had the courage to, in the case of lay people and monks who came to him in the camp, and Tibetans rely entirely for their spiritual sustenance on recitation of prayers. And of course, you were not allowed to move your lips because that might indicate you were saying a prayer, and that was against the rules. So they said the prayers inwardly, but they asked Yangtang Tulku Rinpoche if he would write out the prayers for them because they didn't remember them by heart. So he did that, and of course he got into terrible, terrible trouble and suffered the consequences when he was caught doing that. But he kept doing it as part of his mission. So he had a rough time. He survived. And when he got out, Tulku Tandrup, the Lama who wrote that book, The Healing Power of Mind, said to him, "Yangtang Tulku Rinpoche, what was it really like in that prison camp for you?" And Yangtang Tulku Rinpoche said, "Oh, it was not very, very good for other people. But for me, it was fine." And of course, bearing no grudge whatsoever against the gods and the whole system, in the sense that maybe, you know, that whole imposition of a very deeply unjust system of prison camps and all the rest of it, it was a phenomenon, just phenomena that dissolve into emptiness, you know, and there's no point in wasting time blaming the guard.
Well, at the same time, you've written or been quoted, and I quite agree with you, that perhaps the attainment of sanctity requires a period of anguished awareness of one's own deficiencies. the grave and awareness of the grave sufferings of others. I wonder if you could say some more about that. I mean, we've raised this issue of suffering in a very specific case. Can we talk about it in light of the fact that the Buddha strove to help his disciples be liberated from suffering, and yet you're suggesting with this story that there's a way in which suffering liberates one from suffering?
I think you're so right. In fact, I don't think anything liberates you except suffering. The whole bodhisattva ideal is based on that.
Maybe you should explain the bodhisattva ideal. Yes. There may be people here for whom that's a new idea.
Well, we have a very historically centered appreciation of things, and so the suffering and sacrifice of Jesus Christ is in a historical context for us. Stories that appear to us mythic have also very powerful effect on the Buddhist mind. It doesn't have to be historically centered, but maybe it is, I don't know, this famous story that in a past life, Shakyamuni Buddha, the Buddha that we all know, who taught Buddhism in our time, in our world, he was a bodhisattva. He was a being intent upon attaining enlightenment. And you have to go through, well, endless lifetimes as an ordinary being whose mind is deluded and obscured by emotional defilements like envy and jealousy and hatred and pride and ignorance. And then many, many lifetimes, if you overcome that state of ignorance as a bodhisattva, a being bent on enlightenment, before you actually become a Buddha. And all beings are destined to become Buddhas. In fact, all beings have the Buddha nature inherently in them. It's just that their minds are clouded by these obscurations. So he was walking along and he saw a tigress, and the tigress was very, very hungry, and she had some cubs, and she couldn't feed her cubs. She had nothing to feed her cubs with. And he said, "Oh, poor tigress, how terrible." And he was so overcome with sorrow and for the tigress and the cubs that he just gave the tigress his body. Well, that's very, very much in the spirit of the Christian bodhisattva, the Lord Jesus Christ, to give everything, everything. And that's at the very, very heart of Mahayana Buddhism, that there is no other point. Spiritual attainment has no other point. See, there would be no point in discovering something called intrinsic awareness in Dzogchen unless it was intimately, inseparably related to the function of compassion. That's all. And so, what do you think?
Yes. No, I agree with you. I guess the point at which I have a question is not the aspiration to Buddhahood or not the aspiration toward becoming a bodhisattva, but the help that I need to get there. If I can put it this way, it seems to me, and again, help me, that the figure of the Lord Jesus invites us to come to him if we're burdened and carrying heavy loads, and he'll give us rest, he'll help us to carry those burdens. When I look to the Lord Buddha, he says to me, "Be a light unto yourself." Now, it's a very dark world, and my light is very tiny. Is there some consolation that the Lord Buddha gives me to carry this?
I cannot say whether I'm right in this answer or not. But I think you always have to look in the Pali scriptures at the context. And he was at the close of his life when he said that. And he was addressing highly attained arhats and monks who were close to arhathood, the noble state of having overcome all the defilements and capable of entering nirvana upon their death. And so he was saying to them, don't rely on anything outside yourself, because you know what the scope and capacity of that mind of yours, having undertaken the kind of meditative training you have, is. So just keep on as you've been doing and rely entirely on the training that I've given you and the results so far that you've had, because you're on the threshold, say. And so it was absolutely right to tell them, be a light unto yourself. But it is also true of all of us, ultimately. We have to be a light unto ourselves. And I just had a sort of fantasy or a hypothetical notion that if we were talking to the Rabbi Jesus and we said, as you know, Jesus, I totally rely on you. That's it. I mean, without you, I can't live, let alone have any spiritual life. He might have said one of his famous, extraordinary, unexpected things. Not be a light unto yourself necessarily, but he might have thrown it back to you, because that's what he would want you to do, is to rely on yourself spiritually.
One of those, no one is good but God alone sorts of
that things. Kind of yeah. thing. Yeah. That kind of thing. But on the other hand, you see, with Mahayana Buddhism, ultimately you have to be aligned unto yourself in Mahayana Buddhism and in Tantric Buddhism. There's no question about it. Because there is no place but yourself where there's any light. And you're looking for that light. But in the meantime, you can rely on manifestations of the divine nature, bodhisattvic beings, Buddhas of all sorts and kinds, and you have what is called a yidam, a chosen deity. For example, Tara, the female Buddha, or Amitabha Buddha, the Buddha of boundless light. And Jodo Shinshu Buddhism in Japan, for example, the Buddha of boundless light. Your entire practice could be the recitation and prayers to Amitabha Buddha. But funnily enough, when you come out the other side of that practice, it seems, you find yourself. But this self that can be in a state comparable to what Merton was writing about that you read us, about non-attached mind, you know, and the object. Not John Howard Griffin may have written it or quoted it. Not modifying the object, but seeing into the essence of the object, you know. It might not be that one is, that this kind of devotional practice is anything other than be aligned unto yourself. I don't know. But devotional practice is terribly, terribly important for the very reason you say. Your devotion to Jesus Christ and your reliance on him exists very much also in Mahayana and Tantrayana Buddhism.
I'm sure there are other questions from the audience. And we talked about this for a little while this afternoon. I'm happy to pass this question on again. Did Merton have a premonition about his death?
Well, you know the writings, and I think I spotted three in the book that Brother Patrick Hart and John Montaldo put out of a one-volume edition of the seven volumes of the journals. And I think he did have premeditations of his death, premonitions of his death. I do think so. Claiming special powers, I think I did too. Mm-hmm. Because we were sitting at breakfast once in this bungalow, and he really was hilariously funny. And we laughed so hard that we rocked back on these very rickety chairs. And the ex-monk who was doing the cooking for us would peer around the corner of the room where he had this little primus stove. And he'd never seen anybody roaring with laughter at 6 o'clock in the morning having breakfast, like we did. And then I just turned and looked at him once, and he was in silhouette and completely dark. And I thought, this man is dead. And then I came back to my ordinary mind, and we started to laugh again about something that he came up with and everything, and I didn't think of it again. But in a week or two, a couple of weeks, he was dead. Yeah. Another thing, when I got the telegram from my friend Michael Baldwin, when I was down in New Delhi, after he'd gone to Ceylon and Polonnaruwa and seen the... You know, also, the high point of his trip in some ways, including visually, to Asia, was that visit to the images, the stone statues at Polonnaruwa. He never says in the passage in the journal about being in Ceylon and visiting these statues that made such a huge impression on him. He said, permeated, everything is permeated with the Dharmakaya, the sphere of absolute truth. He had some sort of a realization again. That was the Mahaparinirvana of the Lord Buddha. The Lord Buddha was reclining in the death posture.
Yeah.
And Ananda, his faithful disciple, was standing next to him, overcome with grief. And Merton just referred to it as a reclining Buddha. I'm not even sure he was thinking of the Mahaparinirvana, but it was related to that extraordinary realization he had. Do you see premonitions?
Oh, I do. And I actually don't think Merton knew what those two figures were. I mean, I don't think he... Well, maybe he did. I'm not sure that he would have seen the connection between the imminent passing of the Lord Buddha in that and his own. I mean, I'm pretty sure that was not the case.
No.
But whether he...
But
there is a long passage, by the way, in the Asian Journal, in the full Asian Journal, in which Merton does write about his realization there.
Yes.
Second prayer...
I'm doing a lot of blabbing.
That's all right. They brought you to blab to us. Is anybody bored with Harold's blabbing? In the second prayer that we prayed this evening, someone has noted that the word detachment was used. And the question is, what might Merton say about how one develops in this capacity? What might Merton tell us about developing our practice in detachment? I hope that's fair to the spirit of the question.
I think that in the Dzogchen tradition, if he appreciated those Nyingmapa Lamas and Dzogchenpas, the first thing is relax and don't try. If you try, you get caught like the Brer Rabbit and the Tar Baby in the briar patch and everything, you know. It's very important in the spiritual life to have a sense of humor, said my friend Father Aylward Graham. And I think that Merton would have agreed. I am terribly impressed in his journals about how hard he was on himself. I think, in a sense, that's part of his liberative gift to me, having just read that one-volume version of the journals. Somehow, it gave me so much sympathy for Merton that a man of that tremendous quality of spiritual attainment could blame himself just for things that I can't see in him. You know, his standard was so tremendous. It was before the face of God, so how can one say what he saw? But it was tremendous what he demanded of himself. But that's fine, because he knew what he was up to when he went and committed himself to that very exacting form of the spiritual life. And that's probably the way he had to play it. But he was also exceedingly playful. And I think for most people, most of the time, it's very important if you want to become detached from the five poisons of the mind, as Buddhism puts it, greed and lust or desire and hatred and anger and envy and jealousy and pride and ignorance of how things truly are, the true nature of things, then if you want to become detached from these things, it's important not to concentrate so much on those things themselves, but to simply try to let the thoughts and emotions that surge up in the mind do their thing, be there, and then let them dissolve into emptiness. And if that practice can be carried on sufficiently, then the emphasis becomes more on the emptiness, the empty aspect of the mind, than on the troubling thoughts and emotions that arise. But, you know, we're all in the perfect storm these days. I mean, the context of our lives is so speeded up, and there's so much going on, and we have so many responsibilities and this, that, and the other. It's very, very hard to stand back or get out of the box. But the best way to do it is through prayer and meditation. And the search for detachment side, I think, requires a lot of giving yourself a break, relaxing the mind.
Several of the questions ask about Merton's meetings with the Dalai Lama, and they are along the lines of, could you describe that for us? Could you tell us about the meetings of, or any one of them that particularly stands out in your memory?
Well, the content was very dense because the Dalai Lama wanted to communicate to Merton a lot of information about the philosophical standpoints and the various yanas or vehicles of Buddhism that I talked about with you at the beginning. I think the reason why he wanted to do this was that he saw that Merton was going to make straight for the highest form of meditative training. And so he wanted him to be fully grounded, because the Dalai Lama's tradition of Buddhism is, in addition to being meditative, it's highly scholastic, and it's a graduated path which relies on very logical disputation, dialectical training to refine the mind to arrive at a conceptual understanding of emptiness before one undertakes the practice of meditation. And so one of the sessions between them was devoted to the Dalai Lama sort of outlining to Merton the approach of his own training to emptiness, and then kind of drawing Merton into the conversation and kind of getting a feel for whether Merton had the understanding or not. So that was one thing that the Dalai Lama seemed to want to accomplish, was to be able to communicate a lot of information about Buddhism. Then he wanted to learn a lot from Merton about the spiritual life as it's led in the West. And I have a feeling partly Merton was going to go to Bangkok and give a speech on monasticism and Marxism in the modern world. And one of his... He joked with me and said, nowadays it's every monk for himself. Because in a sense, the monastic life could maybe not have another period as long as the Middle Ages or whatever, and therefore one's going to have to find a way to live a spiritual life on one's own, be a light unto oneself. And so that was something that Merton was very interested in how does one live a spiritual life in the modern world? And the Dalai Lama had to solve that problem too, because his whole monastic structure had been left behind in Tibet, and a lot of it had perished. And he was going to have to try to keep together the shreds of a very great 1,300-year tradition of Buddhism, which had the advantage of very, very secure monastic foundation, you see. So they had a lot to talk about how do you live a spiritual life in the modern world. But as far as the atmosphere went, it was fantastically amiable and very, very cheerful. And it was intense, but relaxed at the same time. So maybe meditative. Mm-hmm. It was very good. And they were two very, very well-assorted people. They were very full, whole people.
Do you want to speak to that one or not?
What is the most supernatural, mystic, impossible event you have witnessed as a student of Dzogchen? Yeah, two. Two for one. Now, this is a believe it if you want, don't believe it if you don't want thing. But we were all in my house, little tiny house near Cape Cod, in a initiatic ceremony, a wang, an initiation, in 1978, and our Lama from Tibet, Golok, northeastern region, had come over to be with us to confer this initiation. And at a certain point in the initiation, rice is thrown as at a wedding in celebration. And the monk who was the master of ceremonies for the initiation put the plate of rice down next to me. And I reached, without looking, I reached in to get the rice to throw. And before I could touch the rice, I felt something come into the palm of my hand. And so I closed my hand and I opened it, and it was a small turquoise, which is a Tibetan stone. And it was, it had embossed in it some crystal. And so it was a turquoise with crystal embossed in it. And I had never seen anything like it. And at the end of the initiation, I went up to the Lama on his throne and I showed him this. And I said, this came into my hand as I was reaching for the rice. And he said, that's Harald's terma. Now, termas are scriptures or objects which are concealed according to the Nyingma Dzogchen tradition by Guru Rinpoche and his consort, Khadro Yeshe Tsogyal, in the 9th century in Tibet, and discovered by successive tetons, mystical text discoverers and object discoverers, in successive generations over the centuries up to our present time, like certain Nyingma Lamas today are tetons or text discoverers. And these are, and also there can be texts that are concealed for the centuries in the mind stream of particular Lamas, and then they just are reawakened and they write them down or have an amanuensis write down a huge long scripture. And these come directly from Guru Rinpoche. So the Lama said, this is Harald's terma. And so I think it's nothing to do with me. It's that I have the good fortune to know these holy beings, and it was I who was, inviting everyone and sponsoring the initiation, and this was a gift from Guru Rinpoche. And then the other extraordinary experience I had from a Dzogchen Lama was that same Lama, Dodrupchen Rinpoche, who comes once every 2 years to this country to teach a handful of students. And he is also a great healer. He's a wonder worker. And he has extraordinary ngunshe, or clairvoyance, too. And there was some kind of terrible gash on the bottom of my foot. And his interpreter, a lovely lady, Simula, found out that I had this gash on the bottom of my foot. And she said, you have to show that to Rinpoche and he will heal it. And I said, I don't want to show my foot to Rinpoche. And she said, you have to. He's a lama. He's a healer. You have to show it to him. So I went into the sitting room and he was sitting in a chair. And I very reluctantly put my foot down. And he got down on all fours on the floor and took my foot. And like Jesus in the scriptures, he spat on the wound. And then he said, now bandage it. And don't take the bandage off. And so that night I went to bed, and in the morning it was healed. So that weekend I saw the Lama, Dorje Rinpoche, at a picnic, and I went up to him and I said, the foot is healed. And he said, Tujiche, thank you. Because he said, thank you for your faith.
There are many questions that we will not get to, and I am delighted that there'll be time after this official meeting for you to speak with Harold unofficially. And I'm going to close with just one quick question, and this will be the last one, and then if I don't know whether there are announcements to be made or whether we can retire to the reception. You wrote about Merton's journey to Asia in an interview in Tricycle magazine, and you said that Merton was a man who found what he was looking for in Asia. And my question is, what was it?
Well, I think he confirmed a lifetime of spiritual practice that it had led to a realization. I think he became aware, fully aware, of the degree of his own realization. By realization, I mean, again, something like that Dzogchen term, intrinsic awareness. A state of awareness of what Buddhists call emptiness and perception. So that perception is that there's no attachment to things, phenomena, and beings, and there's insight into the true nature of things and phenomena, and there's a numinous state of mind that's totally indescribable and transcendent, and only needs to be maintained, not striven for any longer. It needs to be maintained and extended and deepened as the ground of one's being. And I think that he became fully aware of the extent to which he'd reached the ground of his being.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Always, always.